Again, this is a drill that lends itself very nicely to working by yourself. Recruit someone from your family, a teammate, a coach, anybody you can to get this done. These are the little things that separate you from everyone else. You know, ordinary players are a dime a dozen. I can go out to any high school field in the country and find an ordinary player. You need to be that special player, and a special player is a guy that's going to go out and do this on a daily basis. All right, forehand flip. Here we go. Good, then you have to flip. There you go. Make him work. Good. Brent makes a catch. Good. Nice stop. If I don't push him a little bit, I'm not doing him any favors. He wants to be a better player, and the only way to do that is make him work. Okay, one more forehand. Tough one. That's all right. Backhand. Now we're going backhand. Good. See how quick his hand moved? Tough hop. Good. Ball stayed low to the ground. He still made the play. Brent's done this a time or two. He's pretty good at it. See it? Good. See, even on a tough hop, he's still able to get to it. Your hands have to move independent of the rest of your body. If you've got to stop and think about where the glove's going to go on a backhand, you're sunk. It's too late. And you can get to the point where you can feel the backhand and forehand short hop like Brent does. We're in pretty good shape. What we want to do is we want to find a wall. We just picked the back of the dugout. You can pick a wall at home, a school building, wherever. You're not going to tear anything up, a side of an old barn, whatever you like, and work them off the wall. What we're going to ask Tommy to do is to get about 10 feet away from the wall. I'm going to stand right behind him, and when I throw the ball, I'm going to call ball. Any ball that goes to Tom's right, I want him to backhand. Any ball to his left, he's got to slide his feet and take forehand. We want him to start out low. Go ahead, Tom, get ready. He's starting low with his hands separate. If he doesn't do that, he's not going to be able to field any of these. Here we go. Ready? Ball. If you can get a real bouncy ball, it'll come off that wall in a hurry. Ball. Okay. Backhand on that ball to the right. Backhand. Ready? Ball. Good, good hand. See how he cradled it in? Ball. Good. See how he moved his feet? Hands, ball came right up and he went right up with it. Gonna get a little tougher now. Ball. Good. Got a little older player in Adam here. We're gonna make him work just a little bit harder. Again, anything to the backhand side, to the right for him, we want to take it. Be light on your feet. Here we go. Ready? Ball. Good. See how he cradled that ball? He smothered it. This is just like a short hop or a tough ground ball. Ball. Stay down. Ready? Ball. You can have a gold glove competition with this. Line up your entire team. If you drop the ball, bobble it, hits the ground, you're out. And go until you got one person left. Ready? Ball. Good. See how he moved his feet? Ball. Good. If he can square it up, great. Ball. If you can field a ball that somebody can throw from behind you as hard as they can, I guarantee you can field the ball in the game. If you can make your hands move faster than they're ever going to be required to in a game, without question, you're going to be as good as you need to be if you'll work at it a little bit. And the nice thing about this drill is it's fun. It's fast-paced. You can make it a competition very easily, either for yourself. I can remember growing up as a little kid and I had a black spongy rubber ball, and that wall at the front of the house took a beating because I just kept throwing it and throwing it and throwing it. And the closer you get, the faster you move. You can do this by yourself. Adam can take this ball and throw it up on the wall and work himself to the right, to the left, in front of him, whatever you have to do. Make it fun, make it enjoyable, but make it effective.
The next drill that we'd like to show is called the Hauser drill. And a year ago, I was reading an old baseball coaching book. And in that book, a coach named Dick Hauser, who was a great baseball coach back in the 70s, recommended that to increase bat speed, we have hitters swing a dry swing through an imaginary pitch and then return the bat back to starting position rapidly, because he said it developed the antagonistic muscles to the swing. I thought, what a great idea, working on bat speed. And instead of just swinging randomly, though, we added this part where we swing at an imaginary pitch, first up and in, second up and away, third down and in, fourth down and away, and fifth right down the middle. And we do swings in sets of five. And so here you see hitters working on what we'll call the Hauser drill. And we do it with our whole team, where we'll count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and have them swing quickly and return the bat to starting position. We've been doing these in sets of 15, and we do up to 100 swings a night. And I really believe that it's helped our bat quickness and expanded our plate coverage. So that's called the Hauser drill, and we highly recommend it. We'll also use the Hauser drill with broomsticks, and we believe that it increases bat speed even more with a lighter weight instead of sticking a donut on there and having to work a heavier weight. Sometimes we'll use a heavy weight. Sometimes we'll use a drill where we hit softballs with a heavy bat, or then we'll alternate with using a fungal bat and hitting tennis balls, alternating light and heavy. But the Hauser drill has been the favorite one that we've used this year. Might make one more comment about aggressiveness at the plate. How do you teach aggressiveness at the plate in a hitter? We try to do that in scrimmages. When we inter-squad, we don't like to see a called third strike. And any time a hitter in an inter-squad game or a practice game takes a called third strike, the next time he comes up, it's already no balls, two strike count. And he is made to pay a penalty for taking a called third. Now, you may devise your own penalty. You may run him. You may have him do push-ups, or you can think of a lot of things to punish players for. But I found that an effective way is to say, okay, now it's 0-2 your next time up, and you better fight to stay alive. And the internal competition for at-bats seems to be great enough that they'll respond to that. So we try to teach aggressiveness by penalizing for called third strikes in scrimmages. I suppose you could do that in a game if you wanted to, not starting 0-2, you wouldn't do that. But I suppose you could emphasize the same thing. You might run them or something for that as a penalty. But I've always found that punitive measures are not as effective in the long run as our positive means of motivation. Well, what are some running and fielding drills that are important in developing a winning program? When we're indoors, and we have a lot of hurdles available from our track program, and we'll start loosening up with hurdle exercise. It's a stretching exercise where we're stepping over and going under hurdles. It's dynamic stretching. It's not static. Sometimes we'll precede this with some running. But here's a hurdle exercise that we like to stretch the legs. And, of course, I don't think we do enough dynamic stretching. You could even do this outdoors. Sometimes outside, we'll imagine that we have hurdles there, and it saves time setting them up and taking them down. But this first drill is where we kick over the hurdles, and then we step over the hurdles and come down and drag the trail leg. And you can see how that it would stretch the groin area. Then we dip under the hurdles and over. You can just go under and then stand up and go under the next one, or you can go under and then over the next one. And you can see these players doing that. And the last one we do is a bear crawl underneath the hurdles. And some of them get pretty fast at doing this, but it's a good exercise. A little cardiovascular is involved with this exercise, depending on how many hurdles that you use. We like to train them in running form, and we certainly do a lot of form running. One of the ways of working on foot quickness, not only in running, but in fielding, is a wall drill where we lean them against the wall and have them go one step at a time, or and then two steps. They want good body lean. They want to be quick on their feet. And then we go to a third series where we go one, two, three, very quickly. The thigh must come up parallel to the ground. They're going to hit on the ball of the foot, and we just call those the wall drills. And they don't take very long, but they do emphasize foot quickness and running form. The next drill we do is called the karaoke. And most coaches have done this. It's an old football drill, but we adapted it to baseball. And we want to get our throwing hand back and our lead elbow pointed when we come forward with a stride. So the karaoke drill is a drill that contributes to that. And we found that the coordination that's involved is beneficial in throwing. The next drill is knee dips, and these drills are all warm-up drills. We do a lot of knee dips to stretch, again, dynamic stretching rather than static stretching, we think, are most important. Warming up, running backwards is a good drill to use. Again, along with the idea of stretching the antagonistic muscles, if you run backwards, you're working the hamstrings. And we have really, I think, minimized hamstring pulls with a lot of backwards running. We want good body lean and good reach. And then another drill that we like to use is taking a left turn. We certainly do a lot of straight ahead sprints, but we don't want to minimize the idea of turning to the left, because a lot of injuries happen as a player rounds a base, and left turns are the only turns we make on the bases in baseball. So we put three bases out, as you see here, and have them run down the turf room and take a left turn. We like to do a relay drill defensively, and this can be done out on the field before practice starts, or it can be in a gym. And here it's shown in a gym, where we line up the middle infielders in the middle and put the outfielders on the end of this relay drill. The outfielder initiates the drill, and he wants to throw the ball first over the head of the infielder to make him move his feet. You can see that happening here. And then he'll throw the ball short to make him move his feet to come to the throw. And thirdly, after a few throws like that, he'll throw the ball to the front side of the infielder and make him move his feet frontwards, in other words, to the side, and then he'll throw the ball behind the middle infielder and make him shuffle backwards and make a relay throw. So the idea of the infielder catching the ball and moving his feet we use in this relay drill. Another drill that we like to use, and this is more with a team out on the field, is called see and out. And in this see and out drill, we'll have the outfielders in place and all the infielders in position. We'll have base runners at first base and second base. We'll have a batter runner, which are usually extra pitchers, and a fungo hitter will stand behind the pitcher and hit it to the outfielder, who charges the ball and comes up with it on the hop and has to make a judgment where to throw it. We want to keep the double play in order. If there's a play at the plate, if he sees an out at home plate, we want him to go ahead and throw the person out. But most of the time, the throw is going to either go to another base or it's going to be cut off by a cutoff man. So we call that drill see and out. Another drill that we sometimes do in practice is machine bunting. And in this drill, we'll have runners on first and third. We'll have a bunter in the batting cage, and he'll lay down a bunt to the third baseman. We'll have a line of pitchers at the mound and a third baseman. We'll have a first baseman. And the bunter sprints to first base after he puts the ball down. We have a coach that times the runner to first base. And the runner on third, he pretends that there's a fly ball to the outfield. The left fielder who's in this drill will throw himself a pop-up, catch it, and when the ball touches the left fielder's glove, the runner on third scores. Occasionally, we ask the pitcher or fielder who fields the bunt to throw it away over into the dugout, because we want the runner going down the first base line to take a glance over his right shoulder as he after he passes first base, and then makes a judgment on whether he can go to second or not. So we call those machine bunts, and we get a lot of repetitions with that drill. When we take live fungos, we do it a little bit differently than just putting four guys out there and hitting them repeat fungos. You can do that, and that works, but we like to put pressure on the infielders as they field. And we like to hit them three different kinds of fungos. We'll hit them a slow roller, we'll hit them a regular infield fungo, and we'll hit them a ball where they're playing at short depth, we call it three depth, and then have a runner on third base attempt to score, and they have to throw the ball to the plate. If the runner's not going, they'll throw the ball to the first baseman. So we always have base runners running down the line, putting pressure on each infielder as he makes a play. These runners are extra pitchers, the infielder is just under pressure to make a good throw. Most of the errors that are committed in the infield are on bad throws. They're not on muffed ground balls, but they're on bad throws. Another drill that we like to do is where we read dirt balls. We'll put runners on first base, three guys at a time. We'll have a pitcher on the mound. From the stretch, he'll make a move to the plate. The runners take their secondary leads and then read. And we'll have the pitcher either throw a dirt ball or a regular strike. If the pitcher throws a regular strike, they hustle back to the bag. If he throws the ball in the dirt, they read that. They try to read that angle and get a jump and get to second base. So we'll do three guys at a time in that drill. Another drill that we like is called machine gun ground balls. And here it can be done inside or out. And we happen to have a turf room, as you see here, which works very well. But we'll get two fungo hitters, one a lefty, one a righty, and we will just pepper him with ground balls. And it's a great drill for quickness and form and execution. It's also good for the fungo hitters, throwing themselves a good pitch to hit a good fungo. And so we'll hit one after the other at him, and he'll make a play, and he's going to flip the ball, as you see here, to a second baseman covering the bag, who's going to then turn a double play to a first baseman who's out of the picture. Except for this, when he makes the throw to the first baseman, he's going to throw the ball in the dirt and let the first baseman have a chance to work on picking it up out of the dirt, and therefore he's benefited. So we have hitters working on their stroke, we have infielders working on defense, fielding the ball out front and making good feeds, we have second baseman turning it, and then we have the first baseman working on picks. Between innings, we kind of got a little impatient with the traditional way that infielders throw the ball around. Traditionally, a first baseman will roll the ball to the third baseman, then the shortstop, then the second baseman, then they kind of loaf it over to first base, and they get throwing in that way. But I'm not sure that develops players. And if you coach in bad weather, as some of us do, you need all the repetitions you can get where you work on skills. And I actually borrowed this drill from another coach and adapted it. So between innings, what we'll do is we will have the first baseman and third baseman play quick catch to one another while the second baseman shortstop play quick short catch, and then they'll add a few one hops to each other. Then they'll go to their positions and start a routine where the shortstop rolls a grounder to second. They turn a double play. The first baseman throws to third. He turns a double play. The third baseman has an extra ball. He initiates another double play. The first baseman throws outside to second and then inside to second, and they conclude it with a long throw across the diamond from third to first. Part of this drill is shown here. The rest of it is not, and if you're interested, it's in some written material. Or you can adapt it as you want. The point is, between innings, we want repetitions of shorter throws. Don't take as much out of the infielder's arms, and yet get them loose to play the inning. So we're working on a lot of double plays between innings that way. We're working on our feeds from third to second and short to second, and we're working on the first baseman's throw to second, both from inside the line and outside the line, him having to make good throws. Our pregame routine's also a little bit different. We like to hit from center field to the outfielders while the other coach is hitting ground balls to the infielders. After the outfield phase where the outfielders throw to the plate, then we have pitchers throwing Texas leaguers to the infielders. We like that, especially on a new field, to know how to play the sun and to get them used to turning and running on Texas leaguers over their heads. So we'll do that. And then we'll also have three pitchers get in a line and pitchers throw to each base. And so it works with three throwing to each base one at a time. The catcher rolls three ground balls apiece in sequence, and they throw to first base, second base, and third base. This is called the pregame routine on the slide. Now let's talk about some drills for throwing and pitching. The first one we do with the whole team, and it's another drill that I borrowed for years ago from a high school coach, and we call it team throw long. And what we'll do here is we'll get outfielders in right field and in left field, and pitchers can throw in this drill too. We'll put infielders, one at each infield position, in fact two at each infield position, and we'll have two catchers. And as you can see on the diagram here, the drill really has two sections to it. There's two balls going all the time. The right fielder is going to throw the ball to third base, who catches the ball on the hop, ideally, makes a tag, and rolls the ball behind him to the other third baseman or a shortstop who is playing behind him, and he makes a backhand play and throws the ball across the diamond to the first baseman. The first baseman that's caught the ball then returns the ball to the right fielder, throwing long, and the right fielder then makes another throw to third. And of course, you have a line of right fielders, each one getting a chance to throw long to the base. We try to get them to throw so it's not a short hop. We don't want him to throw it over his head. We want one long, nice hop into the third baseman where he can make a tag. The other half of this drill involves the left fielder, catcher, and second baseman, and another first baseman. In this one, it's started by the left fielder, who again may be a pitcher working on his throwing long, and he'll throw a long throw to the catcher, hopefully on a long hop where he can make a tag. These catchers are also working on picking up the ball and making a tag that's low. The catcher then will give the ball to the other catcher, who is between the pitcher's mound and home plate, who throws him a strike. The catcher who receives it comes up and fires a bullet to second base. The second baseman catches the ball, makes a tag, and rolls it behind second to another second baseman who fields a backhand play and throws to a second first baseman over on the line. That first baseman makes a long throw to left field, and the cycle starts again. So we have two balls. Everybody's throwing long. The drill keeps on repeating itself until everybody's had enough long throwing, and we just call it team throw long, and it's a good way to work on the skills of making low throws to bases as well as conditioning the arms. When we condition pitchers, there's a lot of drills that you can do, and I'm not going to try to name them all, but I would like to mention a few where we pair up pitchers and work on our pitches and without taking a lot of throws out of the arm. One of the things that we like to do with two pitchers throwing to one another, we have one get down as a catcher, and of course we're always throwing to a spot, and we tell the pitcher to pick a stitch. We don't tell him to just throw it to the general area or to the area of the mitt. We want him to be so focused that he actually picks a stitch out of the mitt. And I got that from a former Major League pitcher named Jeff Zahn years ago, a good friend, and we believe that it's important to focus on a single spot, a specific spot, more than in general. So we have a pitcher throw to a teammate to the stitch in his glove. Another thing we'll do, and then actually the pitcher who caught the ball as a catcher throws it back, and the first pitcher who threw it is down as a catcher, and we always want them down. We want the throws low. We want to pick a stitch. The second thing that they'll do is work on their changeups a lot, throwing to one another. And again, one of them is always down like a catcher, and you can throw a lot of pitches to work on your changeup with the other pitcher during a warm-up time. Another thing that we'll do is we'll have a pitcher close his eyes and make a throw. In other words, from the set position, he'll take a look at his teammate down like a catcher, and then he'll close his eyes, pick up his lead leg, and throw without seeing where he's throwing. Now, you think that might be dangerous, but you certainly want to start with a wide enough space between groups, but if he learns to trust his sense of feel without seeing where he's throwing it, then he's going to become a more proficient pitcher. He's going to have better control. And we like that drill because he's forced to develop a sense of feel and without using his eyes. Now, certainly we teach a player when he's pitching to keep focused on the target. We want him to pick a stitch. But here's another element to it. We want to isolate each part of his body and try to develop him by having him throw with his eyes closed. A lot of pitching coaches use chair drills, and we do too. We think they're good, and they've been around for a long time. There are about three at least that we like. Here are a couple of them shown on the monitor where a pitcher will throw and follow through with his ankle to the sky or heel to the sky over the end of a chair. It helps him to thrust off the back leg and get out over his front leg a little bit better. So this is one way to use a chair. Another way is to turn the chair and put his back foot on it, and now his weight is already over his front foot. He should lean back on his back leg and load, so to speak, his weight on his back foot, and then shift over his front leg and follow through. So those are a couple ways to use chairs. And then we like this down the hill drill, where we will take three throws down the hill before a pitcher even starts to throw to a catcher. And the idea is to get momentum going to the plate. We think that too many pitchers don't establish the momentum and the timing and the rhythm between hands and feet like they should. And just by shuffling down the hill three times before they even start to warm up, they have warmed up before they start to throw to a target, is an important drill. So we like to do that with our pitching staff. There's certainly a lot more you can do with pitchers. And again, that's the benefit of having a special pitching coach that can teach the different parts of the game. And the more coaches you have, obviously, the better. You can isolate on different parts of the game with the more coaches, but if you don't have many coaches, you can still do a lot, and you can still benefit kids. I hope that these drills have been beneficial to you, and most importantly, that you're coaching for the right reasons, and it's a great benefit to the kids that play on your teams. First question deals with the different kinds of hitters that there are, and do you prepare different types of hitters in different ways? And the answer, I think, is yes. There are different kinds of hitters, and I think it's important for a young person to recognize what his strengths and weaknesses are, and therefore what his mental approach especially should be like when he comes to the plate. The first kind of hitter that there is usually a smaller person who runs real well. And he may not have the strength or the power to hit the ball out of the park a lot, but he can run and he can learn to be disciplined. And a hitter like that, in fact, any hitter that runs, should be working on his drag bunting. He should be able to get a ball down the third baseline or a push bunt to the right side of the infield and work on beating the ball to first base. He needs to think of a high on-base percentage. He needs to be able to steal bases, so he'd work on his jumps to second base and work on reading pitchers' moves. He's going to be a hitter that should be willing to take pitches a lot, to work hitters deep into counts. He's probably going to be a number one or a number two hitter in your batting order. He shouldn't strike out much. He should fight to put the ball in play and use his speed. And so a lot of players who are young and maybe they're not going to be large in body can be very effective players if they'll accept that they shouldn't try to hit the ball out of the park, but should put it in play and try to get on base and try to get themselves into scoring position. The second kind of hitter might be a gap hitter, a hitter who's maybe not going to hit a lot of home runs. He might hit one occasionally, but he'll hit a lot of balls to the alleys between left field and center field and between right field and center field. And he may hit a lot of doubles. And this kind of hitter should hit for a decent average. He's got a little more power. He should be a patient hitter. He should learn to hit his pitch. And he should just be himself. We had a hitter one year who hit 13 triples by the middle of the season when he was on the way to setting a record. And then he tried to be someone that he was not and tried to change his swing and hit the ball out of the park too much. And he didn't hit another triple the rest of the year. So a gap hitter is a hitter that is kind of a cross between a power hitter and the first type of hitter we mentioned. He should be a patient hitter. He may be one of your best hitters. He may be a number three or four hole hitter in your lineup. and he may run well or he may not run great, but he's going to hit the ball with enough power to get himself on second base in scoring position a good enough amount of time so that he's a threat to score for your team. The third kind of hitter is a power hitter. And these guys, you want to sit back and take a good hack at the ball. You can put up with a few more strikeouts with a power hitter who's going to hit a lot of home runs than you can with the other two types of hitters, even though none of us as coaches like strikeouts when we're on offense. But if he's going to hit 15 or 20 home runs in a college season or a high school, probably not a high school season, but a college season, then those runs are going to count for your team, and whoever's on base is going to count for your team. And if he does strike out once in a while, you can tolerate that a little bit more. But he should not be afraid to take a good hack. He doesn't try to hit the ball out of the park all the time, but he's not going to take a half swing. You want him to be selective, get his pitch, be sure to be able to hit the fastball and adjust on a breaking pitch, and go ahead and take a rip at it and not be bashful about his at-bats. So those are three kinds of hitters, and most of the approaches to the game in their cases involve the mental approach in how they approach the plate and their accepting of themselves as who they are and what gifts and abilities they have and using those gifts and abilities to the utmost to help their club. The second question deals with the transition from high school to college, and what do college coaches look for in high school players? I suppose there's a little bit of difference depending on the level of the college program in what people are looking for. But at a small college level, where we are trying to have an outstanding program, we want players that may have been passed over by the very large universities. Maybe they didn't get a scholarship there. Maybe their skills are still very good, and we can offer a scholarship to a person of that caliber. I don't like to give a scholarship to a player, though, that is not a good student and who doesn't care about academics. Because the truth is, our universities and high schools are affiliated with academics, and you must be eligible to play. And it's not a very good business investment as a coach for me to give a large scholarship to a player who really doesn't care to go to school or isn't serious about going to class. We just don't do that. So a high school player needs to do the very best he can in high school to achieve at the highest level possible, score as high as he can on the standardized tests, and a lot of times the test scores that he's had on those tests dictate what academic scholarships he'll get at colleges and universities. So you always want to do your best in whatever you do, and that includes the academics. So we look for that as university coaches. The other things that we look for in position players, it's important that a person have some foot speed. It's important to have a strong arm. Of course, the hand-eye coordination to be able to hit is important as position players. Now, a player that has all those attributes, who can hit, run, field, and throw, and hit with power, he's probably going to be drafted or signed by a large university. But we'll try to get those players if we can, and if not, we can accept a deficiency in one of those areas and still have a good ball club with players that don't have all those traits. So we look for a combination of things. As pitchers, everybody wants a hard thrower, but not all the time are we able to get 90-mile-an-hour plus guys on our ball club. So if a player has good control, if he has a special pitch that he's able to put hitters away with, those are things that make him a valuable part of our team. A left-hander can get by with not throwing quite as hard as a right-hander if his ball moves. So we like left-handed pitchers for that reason. We try to teach movement on pitches and encourage pitchers to develop with their location and their movement as well as velocity, but sometimes it's a little harder to build velocity than it is to the other traits of a good pitcher. So we look for those things in pitchers. But in all the players, we look for character. And if you don't have a player that's willing to learn and wanting to get better, willing to take coaching, then he's not going to get much better. And the idea of character and loyalty and dedication to the game is extremely important. And so we look for that too. I look at how a player treats his parents. and how he's treated his coaches before he's come to our program, because he's probably not going to treat his coach at our university any better than he treats his parents and the other coaches that he's already had. So we look for some character things, and one of the things that I think is the most important is the idea of work ethic. If a former coach tells me that this player has a great work ethic, that's one of the best recommendations that I can hear. And that means that that player is willing to work hard at the game to get better, and he's probably going to listen, and his goals are to improve to the best of his ability. A third question that was asked is concerning coaching our own children. And this is special to me because I coached two sons in college, and they, in my opinion, became outstanding citizens as adults. I think it's a real privilege to coach your own son. And I think there's a lot of variables in that statement, of course. I think it's a lot easier when you coach your own son if he's the best player on the team, because obviously he deserves to play. And in one case, that was the case in my own son. He was an outstanding player, and so there was no question that he deserved the playing time that he got, and he was a successful college player. Our other son is a great young man, too. During his freshman year, though, he was not the best player on the team. He didn't play all the time. He learned to work hard. He developed a really good work ethic throughout college, and he became a player that did deserve the playing time that he got, and he played a lot his junior and senior years and some his sophomore year. So I think it can be a very successful experience and a really rewarding experience, but I think you need to be aware of the abilities of your sons that you're coaching and give them playing time as they deserve, just like you do any other player on the team. You play them as their abilities merit, and as their attitudes dictate. Attitude becomes part of it too, and in contributing to the team. And I think it can be a very positive experience.